Trans Day of Audibility returns to 3CR for its fifth year running. 8 hours of wall-to-wall transgender programming, featuring live music, lived experiences, and dispatches from the front line in the war against reaction. Tune in from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, the 31st of March. 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, 3cr.org.au, 3CR Digital.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Trans Day of Audibility 2026 on 3CR 855 on your AM dial. This is Priya, and I am recording with Willow. Hello, Willow.
Good morning, Priya. Happy Trans Day of Audibility to you. How's it feel to be audible?
Happy Trans Day of Audibility to you. It feels great to be audible, but honestly, you know, I have the privilege of doing a weekly radio show, so unfortunately, I'm audible to people every week. How does it feel to you to be audible?
Well, I'm becoming steadily more used to being less audible now that I'm based in the UK. So this is a nice change up.
Well, okay, that is a bleak way to get into it. But maybe before we dive into our subject, which is Turf Island, Willow, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So as listeners will have heard, my name is Willow. I'm a white trans woman and an organizer, currently based in Bristol in the UK, or Turf Island as it's better known. I grew up on Kaurna country and have spent the majority of my adult life on Wurundjeri country, where I've been organizing in trans and other spaces. And in Bristol, I'm leaning into the disorganizing part of things.
Amazing. And if you haven't had the pleasure of hearing me before, I am Priya. I'm a South Indian non-binary trans broadcaster. I live and work on Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung country here in Narm. And I'm on this broadcast as the ally, but I'm usually just a regular current affairs programmer on the Thursday breakfast program on 3CR. So today, our topic is Turf Island, and we're going to be talking about some heavy stuff. We're not going into heaps of detail, but really thinking about the way that trans people, and particularly trans women, are being marginalized and pushed out of public life, but also the ways that that's constantly being resisted, and that people are building community and holding each other up and making each other feel seen and heard in a world that is becoming increasingly polarized and vicious about gender. So before we jump into that, we wanted to mention a couple of supports that might be helpful if you do find this conversation upsetting. And remember, if you do need to tap out and take a break, that's always fine. We're going to be podcasting this, and you'll be able to listen to everything back, as well as check out our show notes at 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026.
Yeah, let's get into it. But before we do, yeah, a couple of resources to tap into. Thorn Harbour Health have a great counselling service, and Rainbow Door Victoria also have phone counselling 7 days a week from 10 to 5. If anything comes up in the show that kind of hits anything for you that is feeling particularly painful and particularly difficult, I would fully recommend reaching out to these services. Thorn Harbour is on 0398656700 and Rainbow Door on 1-800-729-367. And Priya, I think it's worth saying that these resources aren't really commensurate to dealing with the hectic gender fascism that a lot of queer and trans people are living under today.
Absolutely. And I think the most important thing that you can do is lean into the people that make you feel safe and that make you feel seen, people that you know you can have an honest conversation with, because it is the reality that so many of these services are just not well equipped. I mean, mainstream services are just not well equipped to hold the truth that we live in a transphobic society while supporting somebody who is trans and in distress.
Absolutely. Yeah. Call your friends. Make sure your friends understand what you're dealing with. Go to a trans social meetup. Touch some grass. These are the things that keep us alive.
So, Willow, you moved to the UK a little while ago. Australia, definitely not a paradise for trans folks, but what has it been like to move from here to, you know, the heart of Empire?
Yeah, I mean, that is the move. Maybe a little context for anyone listening at home. So I moved to Bristol January last year. Bristol is a city, a smallish city on the west coast of England, in the southwest Somerset kind of region in the West Country. It's got a reputation for being quite a progressive city, a little bit kind of Melbourne adjacent in terms of the way that its cultural life is like perceived and advertised. And I think that's important context for the situation here, because Bristol is probably one of the most progressive cities in the UK. And still moving from Nam to Bristol was a huge culture shock. I think very much did change my point of view on home as relatively a lot more like a paradise for trans people.
Yeah, I feel like the conversations that we've had since you've moved have increasingly like left me feeling terrified about your safety after we hang up. I'm just like, I can't believe that you're being made to live like this. You and all the dolls need to get back here, which again is, you know, we live in a settler colonial state with a repressive gender apparatus that is connected to the UK. And I think about things like the Cass Review and the worldwide ripples that that has had and the resonances that it continues to have in conversations about trans life. And there's always, you know, flashpoints throughout the year. The most recent thing I can think of is the IOC requesting, again, you know, genetic testing of athletes, but also you can see anti-trans backlash around the world. India just passed a bill through parliament that significantly restricts and changes the possibilities for recognition of transgender people. We're seeing a whole crusade to annihilate trans life in the US. But the UK has been a really, really big part of this, or an epicenter for just the worst TERF imaginaries and then their legislative enablement. So things have been happening like since you moved there. Can you tell us about just the developments that have happened since you moved to Bristol in UK legislation?
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned kind of the central role of the UK in manufacturing this TERFism, because I mean, the UK has always been the factory for gender fascism, right? And this goes all the way back to the beginnings of the British Empire and colonialism. But I'm glad that you mentioned the settler colonial context back where you're recording as well, Priya, because I think there's something that's worth saying at the top, which is there's always been this move in kind of like settler colonial queer politics to frame the kind of settler colony as this like other space where anything is possible, where queer liberation can be achieved, as opposed to the colonial metropole where I'm stuck now. And I want to kind of put that dynamic out there, because I don't want this to be a, you know, Nam is this paradise where we can create our gender abolitionist utopia on stolen land, versus the UK being this like kind of home of repressive gender. It's all much more connected than that. So back in 2024, the British government commissioned a review led by Hilary Cass, which was meant to examine the kind of transgender healthcare system in the UK. And what that review ended up doing was delegitimizing pretty much the entire healthcare system as it existed, which was already deeply underfunded and under a lot of stress because it just did not have the resources to deal with the patients that it had. But what the Cass review did was basically insert a bunch of TERF talking points into the discourse and then stamp it with an official stamp. So now you have the victory of this kind of TERF movement that had been building since the 2010s in the UK in a big way, coming in and providing a report that said defund trans healthcare, make it harder for people to get gender affirming care, to get hormones, to get surgery, all these things. So that has kind of been the watershed moment for trans life in the UK. And since April 2024, we've seen cascading kind of responses and implications of that, including last year, I think it was about this time, I think April last year, a ruling by the High Court, which found that sex was quote unquote biological sex, that gender identification, as they would refer to it, is no longer a protected status in the way that it was under the Equality Act. Yeah, so we've had some really confusing moments since that ruling in April last year, where businesses and organizations have scrambled to interpret what it means that we now have this government-mandated biological sex classification. And there's been a ruling handed down this year that says, well, if you're a business, you can kind of do what you want, but if you're a governmental organization or a workplace, then you need to provide binary gendered toilets, and trans people have to use the toilet associated with their sex assigned at birth, or an alternative gender neutral toilet if one exists. It's basically transphobia, but it's also this kind of forced outing of anybody who is trans in their workplace without being out, and we're just kind of left scrambling with what to do.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush. The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
It's a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Kill your lawn and kick your fence. A show about how we live in the cities and suburbs and the ideologies behind them.
Fridays every fortnight at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR 855 AM.
Rubbish tip to you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Trans Day of Audibility 2026 on 3CR 855 AM. I'm Priya and I'm with Willow, and we are talking about Turf Island and what has been happening recently, but also how this connects to much broader currents of gender fascism in the UK, the US, so-called Australia. And hopefully towards the end of this conversation, we're going to be talking a bit more about ways that trans public life continues to be sustained and thrive, mainly through the labor of trans women. It is a horrifying turn of events. And I, you know, this is always being challenged, but the legitimization of, you know, policing people's gender in this way through legal rulings shouldn't be underestimated. I feel like so much of this comes back to the sort of medicalization of transness and then the interpretation of any biological features that we have is heavily socially coded. And so, you know, at the end of the day, all of these things are embedded with different power relations and handing things to a doctor, even if they're not, you know, an overtly transphobic doctor, to then determine what is and isn't a legitimate expression of gender. You know, when is an appropriate time for someone to get hormones? All of these things are, you know, deeply embedded with social meaning. It's not something that you can just read off a chart.
No, and I think what has happened in this moment is an exposing of these fault lines around medical gatekeeping and trans healthcare and the kind of failures of like a neoliberal gender liberation model. I just want to say, like, obviously trans healthcare hormones should be over the counter and for free. This is straightforward. They should be able to be available within our networks. We should be able to distribute hormones ourselves, but instead we have this model that in different countries is increasingly gatekept now, and kind of always has been, apart from this kind of brief moment in the 2010s where it looked like we were heading in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, in so-called Australia, we did see the RACGP push back against the CAS review's recommendations, but at the same time, you know, whether or not these violent things are codified in law and policy, it happens at the whims of politicians. And we've seen in the Northern Territory in Queensland that over the past few years, there's been a rolling back of the ability of doctors to prescribe gender-affirming medication to new trans patients that are under the age of 18, which is a crucial time for people to access hormone therapy, considering that a lot of people don't, you know, don't want to wait until they hit puberty. And that's not to say that hitting puberty and then taking hormones means that it's too late. That's far from the conversation that we're having, but more that by gatekeeping access to hormones while people already have quite a robust understanding of who they are, we're shutting down so many possibilities for people to live like radically different lives.
Yeah, well, I think the way that we treat like queer and trans youth is such a litmus test for the way that queer and trans people are being treated by society writ large. And like, you know, this move to ban gender-affirming healthcare, whether that's puberty blockers, hormones, whatever, for anybody under 18 is straight out of the gender fascist playbook. And we've seen it be the kind of opening move of that kind of increasing crackdown on trans rights in the UK and in the US. You know, in so many states in the US now, it's no longer possible for people under 18 to access any kind of gender-affirming healthcare. And now we see states trying to do this in so-called Australia, following that model. And we know what's next. It doesn't end at youth. Like, it's a project of demonstrating to the public that trans people are unable to make decisions about their own health and their own identity. And that's coming for everybody. That's not just for kids.
Actually, that's a really important thing to pick up on, because such a crucial part of the sort of medicalization of transness is in so many places having to undergo a psychiatric review to make sure that you have made a competent assessment of your own gender identity. I mean, you have to effectively have somebody say that you experience transness as a pathology and therefore you require treatment.
Exactly. Which just reinforces this gatekeeping model and leaves us vulnerable to the kind of things that have happened now in the UK and that are starting to happen back home as well. But I think there's an element to this that is less kind of intuitively obvious for people who aren't kind of living in gender fascism in the way that, you know, trans people in the UK are, trans people in so-called Australia are starting to experience, which is the kind of emotional atmosphere of this whole thing. Like, there's one thing to say the Supreme Court has banned people from using toilets not associated with their assigned gender at birth. People are still going to piss, and they're going to piss where they want to piss. There's no security guards. Like, it's a completely stupid idea to think that we could actually effectively police toilet usage in every institution across, for example, Britain. But there becomes this kind of level where the public start to do that security guard work. They start to do that policing. And this is something that I noticed as I moved over here and talking to friends who live here. They've noticed it increase so much in the last few years, because people who usually don't have any business thinking about trans people are constantly thinking about us because of the way it's reported, because we're constantly in the media and the courts and in government. And this kind of like outsources the violence of everything to the people around you. So it changes the way it feels to use the bathroom. It changes the way it feels to be on the street. And I certainly noticed that moving here, the amount of unwelcome attention that I was just not used to from living in Nam.
I can imagine that if you are trans, and particularly a trans woman, and especially a trans woman of color moving around in the UK in public space, you constantly have that front of mind when people are all trying to figure out whether somebody is trans and you are trying to just move safely from A to B.
Well, I was just thinking about the, like what you said, being like a trans person of color for somebody living here in that situation. You've got the intersection of this heightened gender surveillance with things like the sus laws, where people of color in cities across the UK are constantly being stopped and searched by police officers. And these things come together in ways that just heighten that atmosphere of violence and surveillance.
I think now is a good time to go to our interview that you conducted with your friend Alara, because Alara really goes into just the everyday violences of this atmosphere of fear and surveillance, but also, you know, shares some really beautiful analysis of what it's like to keep on living through.
I'm here with my friend Alara today, a longtime collaborator, co-organizer, and I'm just going to pass it to you, Alara, let you introduce yourself.
Amazing. Thank you, Willow. I am Alara Sinodori Ala, she, her, mixed Desi transsexual woman. I've been community organizing for over a decade. I founded with my friends, the Trans Feminist Collective in Bristol. I have a lot of experiences, sort of very racialized experiences, but also as a lesbian trans woman as well, both sort of like in London, in Bristol, and in like the UK as a whole.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Alara. I mean, bouncing off of that directly, I wanted to open this interview by just asking, are you okay? Are we okay? Is anyone okay? What is daily life like for you right now?
Wow. Yeah, so I feel like the place to start from is like, no. Obviously, super duper no. Things have been getting harder and harder. It's difficult, right? Because there's like a tension that exists between this, like, my own experience and my own growth into my womanhood and feelings of being like more and more empowered. More and more I feel sort of passively a woman, less like I need to try. And that's sort of part of my own journey with it. But that I have found contrasts with the state of the country, because as I've become more comfortable in myself, things have been getting more and more hostile, and I see it in the women around me as well. Things are getting more and more and more stressful for us.
And on that note, I wanted to ask you, maybe for the listeners back in Nam, how would you kind of summarize what has changed in the UK since the EHRC ruling? And what have you noticed in the changes in the way the public treats trans people?
So there's like a demonization, right? And it's really, you feel it. You really feel it. Like I am lucky in the sense that I've never had like a horrible encounter in the bathroom, but I've not been given side eyes. And like, you know, the way that like kids will like yell stuff and like will harass you and will like chase you. I have noticed an increase in the hostility towards trans women, specifically invisibly trans women. And I found that when I first came out, cis girls were very, oh, you look so pretty, oh, like, you know, where'd you get those trousers? And like nowadays, like if I get clocked, if my teat is clocked, then they see me and they're like, oh, like giving me little side looks and being super duper uncomfortable.
Something that a lot of trans people talk about is like the privatization of violence. Mm. You know, you have like these big state legal handing downs and rulings, and then that becomes something that is diffused through the public and it's enacted every day by people in bathrooms, people on the street, you know, the small kind of micro interactions and the microaggressions. It's definitely something I've noticed since I arrived here. Would you say it's something that you've kind of noticed has changed the way it feels to be trans in public?
Definitely. Mm. And the like the necessity of performativity, like, and as like a brown trans girl as well, like the necessity to pass increases, like, you know, iteratively as like the years go on. And like Britain is such like a society so couched in class and hierarchy that like you can be as anti-class, anti-hierarchical, you could be, you know, the most biggest anarchist in the world, but like I found that like even cis anarchists are getting weird about trans people in their spaces, and that like we have a culture here where whatever is decided in parliament becomes the social norm. And like there is resistance, there is definitely resistance, but that resistance is so much more polarized than it's ever been before. People absorb the culture of the class that's in charge and they emulate it.
This is something I've really noticed, is that in the institutions in public life, whether that's workplaces or universities or kind of the social groups, there is this like disappearing of like that kind of progressive window that opened in the 2010s. You know, there is much less often pronoun badges at the conference. There's much less often the protections at work that, you know, looked like they were coming through in the 2010s. But I guess the question I've got is, how does like the community respond to that? Like, how have you noticed your friends, people in your life who are trans, how they responded to this change. How is it affecting people's mental health? How's it affecting how it is to live?
I think, like, the response, especially, I think, post, like, liberal washing, which is what I would call that period in the 2010s, I don't think we were ever going to get the things we were promised. Always very deeply cynical of that, and from, like, the perspective as a Marxist and all these other things, like, this stuff is always about holding up the class that exists. I think our community has responded in extremely understandably very, like, strongly emotional ways, right? Like, mental health is so much worse, and people are feeling much worse, and there is so much anger. There is so much, like, there is this, like, twin thing of, like, this intense galvanization and this, like, desperate, desperate need to do something, to resist, and at the same time, this relentless sense of just, like, crushing, exhaustive hope. Like, we are all spent. We are so tired. We are, like, not sleeping, not eating. Like, we are, like, finding the need to be together so much more important. But at the same time, like, I see everyone, like, closing in and pushing out simultaneously.
Yeah, that really resonated with me, that kind of window, the liberal window you talked about. I mean, I think all of us have kind of always known that the cosmetics companies are not going to save us. The corporate pride is not going to save us. The representation is not going to be the thing that lifts, you know, poor trans people out of poverty, that spotlights anyone except a few white celebrities. But I guess in the face of that realization, it's still crushing to kind of experience this gender fascism slamming down on all of us, you know. I think you can still feel a bit nostalgic for, like, neoliberal corporate pride when the alternative is ruthless gender fascism. But I wonder on that, like, what does keep you going? What kind of responses are you seeing in the community that kind of give you hope or at least galvanize you?
That's so important because obviously, like, you know, we've got to celebrate the victories where they exist, right? Because it feels very few and far between. My strength is very personal, comes from my friends. And, like, the community that we've managed to build, especially out here in Bristol, you've been a big part of that as well. Like, in the past year or so, the trans feminist collective is not even a year old at the time we're doing this interview. And, like, in that time, there was no real voice for trans women in this city, like, independently. You know, there's a lot of misogyny in the queer scene. And something that I'm still facing is that, like, there's a lot of, like, you know, inherent and implicit racism. And so the thing that keeps me going personally is the relationships I've developed with all of the, like, incredibly beautiful and talented and just, like, driven and insane and, like, you know, like, really sort of, like, you've known this, you've met the British trans women, like, there's an intensity here, like, an emotional intensity. I can't speak to what it's like in Nam, but, like...
I think the stakes are higher here. I would say that in a lot of ways. The stakes are a lot higher.
And so, like, it produces this kind of, like, group of incredibly, like, emotionally vibrating people. And I have so much love and respect for, like, the peers that I've, you know, come up with. And it's those people that, like, really drives it. And also just seeing, like, another generation of women who've come out post-COVID and being able to hold space for them and build community for them is... I'm so tired and exhausted, but also so happy that there is a space with other trans women that wasn't there when I came out.
This is it. I think this is a space to come together and be together by us and for us is singular achievement. And like you said, it's not even a year old, but yeah, I think it's something to be really proud of. I'm going to end on a slightly lighter note and ask you, for the listeners back home, is there any UK-specific slang, trans slang or broader that you could share to just give a slice of life over here?
Let me give you a little slice, babe. Let me give you some slices. There's like, I feel like, you know, as is the way across, like, a lot of the doll communities, like, a lot of it has just been imported. It's like AAVE, like, Borum, like, slang from New York and from the Borum scene in London. So I feel like a lot of the doll slang... It's very hard to say what's, like, UK-specific without, like, claiming someone else's culture. But, like, I don't know. I'm always dropping, like, London bits, like, you know, bits in it. You ask me something, you'll tell me, like, I bought a new top today. It's really cute. I'll be like, is it? You know, like that kind of.
So confusing.
Yeah. And I'm just I'm just like everyone's saying all right to each other as well. Mm. You know, I'm slightly self-conscious because my girlfriend says my slang is like, you know, from 2010. But like, I'm a girl of an age from a city of a time, you know, I can't help it. Yeah. It's not my fault. But like, apart from like the classics, like, wow, this is, man, allow it.
Mm.
Meaning stop. There you go.
I like it.
You like that?
Let's allow it. thank you so much, Lara, for chatting. Time to go, kind of money, gonna roll the wheel. Say I love a taxi, gonna take the wheel. Oh, you think I'm lying? Money on the fish, you get the idea. Rich girl, lots of things, it should make you whole. And you pop off of mine, just a cup of pill. Oh, you think I like it? Leave it to me, because I'm now up shit.
That was British Girl by HTML Jones featuring Beardex and St. Raven. And Ishani, aka HTML Jones, has a surgery fundraiser, which we will have links to in our show notes at 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026. Now, Willow, I wanted to reflect a little bit on that conversation that you had with Alara, because it really was such a beautiful discussion. And you brought up some things that I think are really important to keep unpacking. And one of them is this notion of the privatization of violence. Can you talk a bit more about what that means?
Yeah, I can. I think when we talk about the privatization of violence, it is this thing that Alara was tapping in on, which is it's the atmosphere of fear around. It's the sense that cis people in the UK can't be trusted because every cis person is tasked with policing the gender of every trans person. It's this kind of thing where the government sets a law, they have a legal ruling, and then they just kind of put it out there through the media and they expect everybody else to enforce it.
Yeah, like the way that this functions, not just in mainstream society, but across the different subcultures that we're a part of, is really terrifying. Just the fact that people absorb this messaging to the extent that they're regurgitating transphobic talking points or, you know, gatekeeping spaces in a way that particularly doesn't make trans women feel safe in them is something that really was notable in what Alara was saying about cis anarchists getting weird about trans people in their spaces, because this is, you know, it's not something that we talk about enough. I think the conversation about gendered violence and misogyny in anarchist spaces has been happening for a while, but I think trans misogyny in the various subcultural spaces that we occupy is something that gets far less attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for me it always comes out in the kind of literalness of people's responses. For me, that privatization of violence, the kind of like hidden transphobia and trans misogyny, is what keeps my friends at home and keeps them out of organizing groups. It's when I notice the people I love and care about feel really uncomfortable just being in public and walking around together. When I see them getting kind of harassed in their workplace and feeling like they don't have any way to stand up for themselves without being misinterpreted.
the fact that a privatization of violence manifests in people withdrawing from public life is producing precisely the kind of effect that these laws are meant to have. They're meant to shut down and silence and remove trans people from public life. And so, you know, when people make the very reasonable decision to say, you know what, I don't feel safe outside, I think I'm going to stay indoors more, I'm not going to go out alone or at night, you know, there's a self-exclusion process that plays into the kind of dynamic that transphobes are trying to create. But also there is an immense amount of power in publicly taking up space and building community in an intentional way that is visible and that calls people to be visible together in a really caring and collective model. And you've been involved in that here with the Touchgrass picnics, and you've also been tapped into some of those groups in the UK.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. The goal of these laws, I think it's easy to get scared into believing that this gender fascism is going to look like, you know, very violent, very obvious forcing of trans people out of public life, which, yes, that is part of it. And especially for certain groups within the trans, like, umbrella and within the trans community and trans people of color and trans migrants and refugees. But in reality, what it's trying to do is get us to push ourselves out of public life, get us to feel like we need to detransition in certain spaces or to go stealth or to simply stay home. And the cure to that, the response to that is to push back and to say, no, we are here. And we have to be strategic about that because it's harder to be in public. So building collectives like the Bristol Trans Femme Collective, which has come into being in the last year, creating spaces where people in Bristol and especially trans femmes in Bristol can meet and be together and feel comfortable hanging out in a public place. Like, this is, it can't really be oversold how important that is. There's this level of like intentional presence that is exactly the foil of what this private violence is trying to do.
Yeah, and I think something really beautiful that I've seen from the way that these kinds of events run is that it's not calling for any particular kind of normative gender expression or engaging in a specific way, but more just coming together and sharing space in public in a way that feels, you know, like the bar to entry is so refreshingly low for engaging in a space of trans public life.
Exactly. And, you know, what we can do together is bring down that bar and make it easier for each of us to access care and community. There's a great book that came out, I think it was earlier this year or maybe last year, by Dean Spade called Love in a Fucked Up World. And I've been reading it recently and really loving it because what Dean is talking about is this idea that as things get harder and as this crisis deepens, which it will, as all the kind of like poly crisis in the world continues to build, we actually have to build our skills for caring for one another and being in relationship. And we do that by organizing events together. And we do that by doing mutual aid together. We do that by checking in on our friends and also by organizing political rallies and speeches, followed by a meal, followed by drinks. All we have is each other. So we have to work on these skills.
Yeah. And, you know, when you are navigating a world where you're made to feel vulnerable all the time, actually choosing vulnerability with each other on your own terms is a really powerful thing to do.
Yeah, even if I can just talk to it on a personal level, like every time I get the opportunity to hang with other dolls for a night, it changes my week. Like, you can turn my entire mood around. And I don't realize how much I've missed it until I get there and I'm kind of with other trans women, with other trans people. And it's, yeah, nothing compares.
You're tuned in to Trans Day of Audibility 2026. It is the 31st of March, and you are listening now to myself, Priya, from Thursday Breakfast, and Willow, and we have been talking about what life is like in Turf Island, aka Great Britain, and oh my God, why did I say that? British, innit?
No, I really liked it. You have to keep that in.
And now we're going to listen to another track. This one is Anomaly by Narm-based musician Katie Day.
just hear the haze of toxic pink break through the dusty ground. I could be gone so quick.
You are listening to Trans Day of Audibility on 3CR, and that was Anomaly by Katie Day. You can find her on Bandcamp, in the show notes, and often at Miscellanea if you're there on the right night.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
You are listening to 3CR's Trans Day of Audibility 2026 broadcast, and this is Priya from Thursday Breakfast. I've been chatting with Willow, who is currently based in Bristol, and we've been talking about Turf Island and what it's like to live there under increasing gender fascism, about the resonances that has with so-called Australia, but also about the beauty of intentionally cultivating trans public life and gathering in public space. So with the time that we've got left, I thought that we could share a couple more reflections about what's been happening, especially what's been happening here, and then, you know, some of the positive stuff that people can tap into if they are interested in connecting with other trans folk.
Great. Yeah, I think thinking back on everything we've discussed today, it's easy to see Turf Island as this place that's over there. You know, bad things are happening here where I am, and some of those things are very specifically British. It's a very British gender fascism that's going on. But we're already seeing a lot of leakage of that style of gender politics into Australian public life, right?
I think you've touched on something that is really important, which is the style of gender politics might be, you know, diffusing from the UK to here. But also, you know, that is complementing a gender fascism that is organic and already created from settler colonialism here. And so I think when people talk about, you know, what's being imported versus what's not, recognizing that colonial gender normativity has established a particular status quo for, you know, how we treat gender difference. People can't see that I'm doing air quotes, but that has been now overlaid with this really aggressive attack on trans life that has come from more recent things like the caste review. So there's been a much longer process underlying this, but then the style of politics that is coming out of the UK is gaining more and more uptake here as well.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, this is not the first wave of gender fascism or gender politics to emanate from the colonial kind of metropole out to the supposed, like, I'm doing air quotes too, like margins of the settler colony. But like in the same way that we follow doggedly in the footsteps of the US and the UK into wars and genocides in the Middle East, into support for economic policies that ruin people's lives, and into a denigration of like the continent that is currently known as Australia, as this place that is ripe for exploitation, we also import a gender politics that exploits people and follows the lead of these places that we, for some reason, think we need to follow. Or I'm saying we, but you know, it's certain people in certain positions of power. And I think we can't get complacent about this because we're already seeing in the effects in the media. Recently, there was an ABC report on the 23rd of February about the Lesbian Action Group, which is a TERF group with a very small membership, but they've been kind of outsized vocally because they've been taking the government to court over laws that prevent them from excluding trans women from their gatherings. I want to be clear, I don't think any trans women want to spend time with these people. However, they are doing this as a publicity stunt. It looks like they might lose, but in the reporting, we're already seeing the ABC, the national broadcaster, using language that emulates language used by TERF and like gender fascist publications in the UK, describing in their initial report, describing a sentence where they say they would exclude all males irrespective of whether they identify as women, which is the most roundabout way to misgender trans women that I've heard in a while. And it's telling that they've updated this and since edited that phrase out. But I think what we're seeing is like this unthinking kind of uptake of the language and discourse that's used in the UK. And this is part of like neocolonialism. We have to push back against gender fascism and colonialism at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's such like rank cowardice as well to allow this to pass editorial review. I mean, to write it in the first place and then have it pass editorial review and then to sneakily make a little change. And pretend that nothing ever happened.
Yeah, to be clear, they don't say anywhere that the article has been updated or revised.
Yeah, it just, like, the level to which people will, on the one hand, engage in such a petty but violent act of gender policing, and on the other hand, pretend that it's, like, completely inconsequential and therefore doesn't warrant an editor's note saying we've actually made this change in response to a recognition that that was a terrible thing to publish in the first place, shows how normalized it's become in our public discourse, which is, you know, all the more reason why we need to constantly call it out and fight back against it. It's not being pedantic. It is recognizing the level to which this is seeped into, or like, you know, has always been a part of our culture and is activated in particular ways that, you know, is not always going to sound like a dog whistle to people.
Exactly. Yeah, this is how this stuff gets normalized. And yeah, I'm glad we're talking about it now because we need to get onto it as fast as we can.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to land this conversation on some soft grass, somewhere that people can build a tangible personal connection with each other, and especially again thinking about the importance of this for trans femmes and trans women. Talk about the Touch Grass picnic, because you were involved in it here, you're involved in other iterations in the UK.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago some friends and I got together and decided that we wanted a space where trans femmes could hang out in public outside of a venue, outside of a place where you needed to buy a drink to feel like you could be there, or, you know, outside of the kind of nightlife hours that often a lot of us had spent time together. We thought, let's start a picnic. So we decided that everybody that we knew needed to touch grass more often, and thus was born Touch Grass Picnic, which has been running for the last couple of years now throughout the summer and kind of warmer months. We usually meet in Eddie Gardens and on a Saturday or Sunday, hang out for about 3 or 4 hours. And we've had up to 50 attendees at different events. And honestly, it has been like brain chemistry altering to have, I think, that many trans femmes in one place for a lot of us there. And I would implore anyone who's listening to come along to that Touchgrass Picnic. It's at Touchgrass Picnic on Instagram. As it is winding down for this year, as it gets a bit cooler, we'll be picking up again in the summer months. And I will also be back, so I hope to see you there.
Amazing. And do you want to shout out any of the collectives that you're involved in Bristol, just in case we have any listeners from over there who might be tuning in because they know that you were on the show?
Yeah, and I will say also the trans femme groups that meet up here in the UK love visitors from overseas. So if you end up in London for a week or in Bristol, God forbid, for a week or two, then come along. Bristol Trans Feminist Collective is one. You can find them on Instagram just by searching that. And then there's also the London Trans Femme Meetup, which I will put in the show notes as well. And that is run by Magda.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Willow. Is there anything that you want to add before we wrap up?
I think that's it. I think it's been such a pleasure to chat today. And looking forward to checking in a year and talking about how we crush gender fascism.
God, I hope we don't just check in a year. I hope I'll speak to you sooner than a year from now.
Yeah, please, please take me home.
That's all we've got time for today, and we're going to leave you with a lovely little track to tie things off. But remember to stay tuned all the way through till 6 p.m. for 3CR's Trans Day of Audibility 2026. And to access our show notes and see what's on for today, as well as listen back to all of the segments, you can head to 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026. And now we're going to leave you with a final track for today. It's Latex and Gasoline by UK-based trans anti-fascist anarchist musician Floralis, featuring Valhalla Kid.
Basically, we have no rights. We're animals, we're creeps, we're f***s, we're sissies, and abominations of God.
And this is according to who?
Administration, directors, wardens, staff.
Well, all I want some latex and some gasoline. Well, all I want some latex and some gasoline.
Say, do you think I find it easy, boy? Believe me, I never thought I'd ever see some peace in life. You said you're an anarchist, a joker kid, but did you only ever really want to kiss me? So tell me what I don't know, or touch me, homo. You never want to burn some shit, I'm getting sick to death of this. Flip the dust with us, make yourself useful and grab my neck a bit. We've only got some months left to live, you're lucky you've got super soft lips. Well, all I some latex and some gasoline. Well, all I want some latex and some gasoline.
You say the times are improving. I ask you how do you know? You say that we're getting older. I tell you shut up and cheer me up. Don't make me throw up. But I think you're all the blood and lies.
Ya le encanta la gaso, dice que quiere mis manos debajo de la mesa y aún preguntando si a un futuro que nos quieres, si a un futuro que te espere cuando no me identifico con los machos en el centro, dreaming of young Mico en Fercho, gritando letras de embrismo del techo, un comunista que se chingue a los cerdos. En el abismo del binarismo, sentía que en mi vida le faltaba ritmo, y baby cuando chingamos se siente rico, pero siempre quieren que lo justifique contigo. Cuando estamos solos no puedo escapar, los comentarios de la gente que quiere matar, que no sabe amar, y yo solo en el mar, consciente que solo yo puedo salvarme.
Some latex and some gasoline.
Thank you. As we are human, so we are creative. Creativity is inherent within us all. Creating affirms more than consuming. No creative pursuit is gender bound. The trans, gender diverse, and non-binary culture is valid, critical, vital, and vibrant. The mainstream culture relies on our culture, not vice versa. The Trans Creatives Global Corporation presents the Trans Creator Radio, a cacophony of trans love, community, and hubris. Trans Creator Radio is a community radio show whose principal interests are creativity, cultural hyper-awareness, extreme social assertiveness, minimal apologetics, and sheer ostentatiousness.
Fortnightly on Friday from 9 to 10 a.m.
Welcome to Trans Creator Radio on 3CR.
Join us on The Vibe Consultant on a Tuesday from 2 to 3 p.m.
A fresh music show where we bring you something weird and wacky every week.
On Community Radio's home of eclectic music, 3CR.
LGBTIQA plus people, that's come from a large history of people standing up and acting up for our rights and our communities.
Talking queer Pacifica, talking about us.
You know, this very like violent act of like hatred and bigotry towards trans people, where they demonise the image of trans people, especially trans women.
For working class queers, for queers of colour, for those who are poor and homeless, the struggle is continuing.
3CR, stay tuned, stay radical.